Okay, we are looking at lesson 45 on the, a little bit more on the subjunctive and clause, subordinating conjunctions and relative clauses. And we left off on page 272 here discussing the use of may in this sense of a conjunction itself, meaning lest or in order that not. Something might, in order something might not be. And I think we're just beginning to look at some of the examples here. It frequently follows verbs meaning fear, be afraid, have a care, and this use is sometimes strengthened by the addition of pos or potet. These combinations sometimes written may pos, may potet, sometimes may pos, may potet, separate words. So we looked at a few examples here. Watch therefore, lest coming he suddenly finds you sleeping. So may elthon exifnes, interesting word, ure. Now there's a subjunctive form, and we've got may just being used all by itself, not as a negative here, but as a conjunction here, meaning lest. Of course, it's got the kind of an idea of a negative as well, in order that not. It's just you're getting this in order that sense from the structure and the use of it. Then may post here in 2 Corinthians 12:20. For boomai gar may post elthon uk hoyos fellow hero humas. For I fear lest when I come, I may find you not as I wish, or I may not find you as I wish, or it's probably better I may find you not as I wish because the uk there. Now, the may post here is just being translated lest. And then we've got one with may pota, in order that the disciples may not steal him. May pota, elfontes, poimate tai, klepsosin auton. So stealing, we get kleptomaniac from this root here. Okay, now a remark here, except with the verbs of fearing constructions with hina may, hopos may, are to be preferred to those with may, maypos, maypote. So, there are certain, in other words, with verbs of fearing and this type of thing, you're going to see the construction that you've seen just seen. But then with other types of verbs, you're normally just going to see hiname and hoposme, and that would be the idea of lest, in order that not. That's kind of just a literal, hina means in order that anyway, and then may would be the negative for it. So that's what you're most likely to see. But with certain types of verbs in certain situations, they'll just use may or may post. Yes?
What's the difference between hiname and may? Because they're the same.
Yeah, they're translated the same. There isn't any difference in the meaning in this construction. The only difference is that hiname is used most often in almost, you know, any kind of situation, and just may by itself is used with verbs of fearing, being afraid, that type of thing. Verbs of fearing take may. So apparently the construction is such that it looks like the may is kind of a shortened form, and since people do a lot of fearing, you know, you're probably going to see this quite frequently. You know, fearing lest this should happen. You see, it's almost getting into an idiomatic type of construction. And I think that's the only difference. Because he's saying as a general rule, you're going to see hina me, hopos me, and just do it. That would be your more unambiguous literal structure. And then this section on may is just kind of a peculiarity, a idiomatic type of situation with verbs of fearing. Okay, then the fourth point here, heos, until, is used with the aorist subjunctive with or without the particle on to indicate that the beginning of an event is dependent upon circumstances. Okay, and so we're using until here, but we're using it with an aorist subjunctive. And we're seeing cause and effect type of relationships, a certain dependence of one event upon another. And so examples, I think, is the best way to describe this. Isthia ke haos on apo soi. Be there until I tell you. Be there until I tell you. Now, here you're seeing a situation where the beginning of one event is dependent upon circumstances. So he's saying, be there until I tell you, and the beginning of a certain event would be not being there anymore, and that event is contingent upon the telling. So he says, do this until something else until I tell you. And the telling, of course, is going to result in the beginning of another event. Another example here, you will not finish the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. Okay, so ume, you shall know wise, ume telesete tas poles to Israel, haos elthe hohuyos to anthropu. So again, you're not going to do this until the Son of Man comes. All right, again, this event of finishing the cities of Israel is contingent or dependent upon the Son of Man coming. And again, we see this kind of a relationship. So this, you're dealing with time relationships, and you're dealing with the necessity of one event occurring before another. And so he'os, until, is used in that sense. Now, clauses with similar meanings are introduced by he'os hu, he'os hotu, achris, achris hu, mechris, and mechris hu. We've had some of those particles before in conjunction, so similar situations will be encountered there. Okay. That's just using he'os with relative pronouns of various cases and so forth. And then achris and mechris also. Okay, do we have any questions on those? Because the next sections are going to be a little bit more difficult here. They're not really that hard, just trying to remember A, B, and C type clauses, I suppose. Section 350, yes, great.
You mentioned back here with the use of may.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just starting to look at it. I'm wondering, couldn't you say this as well, like that coming suddenly, he may not find you sleeping?
Yes, you can say that.
It doesn't seem like that'd be the
yeah.
Literal rendering, and that would be justice as far as I can tell.
Yeah, there's a certain sense. Well, you can probably do it that way. You can probably do it that way, and not. There's a certain kind of a conditional type of sense that's there. If you translate it that way, you're transmitting that. It's just a little bit different. In other words, English normally does it with something like lest. I think that's his philosophy. This is the way English usually does it. And that kind of philosophy is okay sometimes, but it can get you in trouble sometimes too. So, like you say, it's not going to hurt you to translate in a real literal way like that. In order that not, you see, he kind of gives that there too. And if you just take, you know, that this had not happened, you know, you have the same sense. And if you're ever in doubt, that's certainly the way to do it. You know, if you're in doubt about it and you're not quite sure what's happening, just translate it real literally and see what comes out. And if it doesn't make any sense, you may have to put it in the English idiom. But I always like to start with a literal and then go from there. Because if you don't understand it literally, it's highly unlikely you're going to get a paraphrase right. You probably, you know, diverge from that. So in order that not is an equivalent to lest here, so... And that's a very literal equivalent, especially when you have something like hiname, this more regular form, hina in order that and may not, you know, and then with subjunctive, of course.
I was thinking that you might be able to pick up your purpose just from your participle
delta. Oh. Well, you can, except participles can be used without purpose, too. So I would say the participle plus the structure, you know, just plus the phrase structure, the fact you've got a dependent clause and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of cues that are there that you may not be aware of that are giving you information. And so it's the whole contextual structure plus the use of may and so forth in addition to that. In other words, the only way they're figuring out that may is used this way is because context is showing them that it is. And if you've got this construction, even if you don't have a hina there, you're seeing there's a dependent construction going on just because of the context of the phrases. And then you're just seeing a may without a hina there, and then you're concluding, well, it must be lest or in order that not because of the construction. So that's really what's happening there. And probably abbreviations like that can happen in a language because there's enough cues in the constructions and so forth to enable no confusion to be transmitted linguistically when you do that. Okay, Glenn.
On the Matthew 2:13 example.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That form is identical to the indicative
angle. Uh-huh.
How do they know that he is subjunctive here?
Well,
I look at that and I can see that in what's the difference in the meaning then, and how is he carrying it? I don't get it.
Well,
I guess it's a little ambiguous.
The form is ambiguous.
Sure.
The form is ambiguous, but look at that little particle on just in front of it. That's going to be your tip-off on those. That's going to be... I'm trying to think now if you'd ever see that without the subjunctive. I don't know if I want to say that dogmatically, but in a construction like this, that's a tip-off when it comes right before the verb like that. That's going to be a real key. I would say on plus the dependent clause structure. He'os on like that. You see, when you see he'os, you've got until, on. In other words, the combination of those words plus your form there is going to be what's telling you all that information. But admittedly, there are forms that are ambiguous between conjunctive and indicative. So the only thing you can do on that is look at the rest of the context. And something like on here is really going to be a tip-off for you. That plus the construction, that you're seeing. In other words, if you're seeing on within a clause relationship in a dependent clause, there isn't anything else it can be. And that may be part of the reason why at times it's real important to stick that in there. You can get by without it sometimes, but if you've got an ambiguity in your verb, you better do something to resolve the ambiguity, unless you purposely want ambiguity to be transmitted. That may be possible in some instances, but if you don't want ambiguity to be transmitted, you need to do something when the verb forms like that. And see, that happens in English too. There are lots of verbs in English. In fact, in English, for the large part, the subjunctive and the indicative are exactly the same forms. And we're getting subjunctive meaning from just other things in the context and so forth, or the way that that form happens to be used with other words, and then we get this idea transmitted. So it's not as crippling as it may seem to have this kind of thing happen. It's just a matter of looking at the context again. Greek is not as dependent on context as most other languages that I've encountered, especially Hebrew. But there are places where it is, and this is one of them. Okay, section 350, the subjunctive is used. Now we're going to get into conditional clauses. We've already had things along these lines to some extent before, but now we're going to go into it in more detail and really look at the meat of the matter here as far as these clauses are concerned. And conditional clauses turn out to be very important for us in the New Testament. When we're studying New Testament grammar, of course, we're going to lay emphasis on the things that the New Testament is doing. And conditional clauses, of course, because of the nature of the New Testament, because when you're dealing with covenants, when you're dealing with commandments, when you're dealing with promises, if you will do this, then such and such, you're going to have lots and lots and lots of conditional clauses. And so this is something that's very common in the New Testament, and therefore we need to spend some time looking at it. So the subjunctive is used in certain types of conditional clauses. A conditional clause, obviously, is one which expresses a condition. Conditional clauses are grammatically dependent and are joined to other clauses which express the result or conclusion following from the condition. The clause which expresses the conclusion is independent in form. That is, it could stand alone grammatically as a sentence. A sentence consisting of a conditional clause and a clause expressing the conclusion following from this condition is called a conditional sentence. Conditional sentences in English are very similar in structure to conditional sentences in Greek. In English, the conditional clause is usually introduced by if, and its verb may be in any tense. The form of the conclusion may be quite varied. So here he gives us some examples of this. But basically, a conditional clause is an if-then type of situation. If such and such, then such and such. And your conditional clause would be the if clause. Your independent clause would be the then clause. And the then part can stand pretty much by itself, but the if part doesn't. In other words, if you say, if he does this and stop there, you haven't completed the thought. You're leaving the people hanging, waiting for what you're going to say. But if you say, for example, here's an example. If he does this, he does well. The phrase, he does well, can stand by itself. That's an independent clause. But the phrase, if he does this, doesn't. So that's what his point was above there. But notice here, looking at the examples. If he does this, comma, he does well. If he does this, he will do well. If he does this, let him do well. If he does this, will he do well? Making a question out of it. If he did this, he did well. Or if he did this, he would have done well. You see, there's a number of possibilities as far as tenses. You can start off with the present. The first four of them start off with the present tense in the first clause. And then in the second clause, we go from a present to a future, to a kind of adjusive idea. Then to, again, another future, and making it a question. And then the last two, if he did this, we start off with a past tense. And then either a past tense or more of a perfect idea, he would have done well. So that's just a bit of the flavor of what can happen in English on this. Many other examples could be constructed, of course. So we're just trying to prepare you a little bit for what Greek's going to do as well. Okay, now section 351, conditional sentences in Greek may be most conveniently classified according to the form of each of their constituent clauses. And so he breaks it down into type A, type B, and type C here. Not that these, of course, are things that a Greek person speaking is cognizant of all the time. It's just a type A clause, you know, he's not thinking that way. These are just breakdowns and analysis as far as what can be observed from the New Testament in the ways in which clause relationships are constructed. So, type A clause, you'll see here, he's broken it down into the kind of thing you'll find in the conditional part and then the kind of structure you'll find in the conclusion. Type A has, in the condition, it has A, we've had that word before, meaning if. A with a verb in the indicative, in any tense. If there's a negative, it is usually U. Of course, U is your negative for the indicative. So, we're just using an ordinary indicative clause for the condition here. And A with the indicative in any tense, and then U is a negative. The conclusion will be a clause with a verb in the indicative, imperative, or subjunctive in one of its independent uses. Now, the independent uses are the uses that are discussed in sections 343 to 346. In other words, independent uses mean independent clause. In other words, whether used in an independent clause, it can stand by itself. You know, that was your hortatory subjunctive, and prohibitory subjunctive, deliberative subjunctive, so forth. That's what those sections we're talking about. That's to be contrasted from the use of the subjunctive in subordinate clauses and that type of thing, dependent clauses, where you have hina or something like that. So you see the conclusion in a conditional is going to be an independent clause. And so if we see a subjunctive, it's going to have to be in one of its independent uses, not in one of its dependent uses. That's the sole point. So basically, a type A is going to have indicative in the condition and about anything in the conclusion. The main thing for categorizing it as type A is the kind of condition, the kind of tense, or excuse me, a mood that you see in the condition using the indicative. And then the conclusion can be just about anything. Then type B is using on with a verb in the subjunctive. If there's a negative, it is usually may. So type B is using the subjunctive in the condition, and then the conclusion is the same as type A. In other words, it can be anything, indicative, imperative, subjunctive, so forth. So type B is distinguished from type A in that type B is going to use subjunctive with on, and type A will use the indicative with A. And still translating pretty much the same. In other words, in English, the type A is going to be if such and such, then such and such. The same is going to be true of type B as far as our translation is concerned. And the difference as far as nuances and so forth are concerned might be worthy of some study. Most of them just say they're the same thing. Although we will see here a breakdown further on that gives you some insight into the choice of type A or type B in terms of the degree of probability or possibility that the speaker perceives the situation to involve. So I guess I'll hold the details of that a little bit later. It's coming to the next page anyway. Type C is A with a verb in the past tense of the indicative. Usually the negative is may. And now this is different than type A in that in type A it could be in any tense. Type C is kind of a special case in which you find only a verb in the past tense, and then the conclusion is a clause with a verb in the past tense. Not necessarily the same tense as the in the A clause of the indicative, and with the particle on. So, and we'll see what kind of situation this is used for. But type C involves past tense in both the condition and the conclusion. And in the condition, it's past tense in the indicative, and the negative is usually may, which is kind of interesting because may is normally not used as the negative in the indicative, but since it's a conditional situation, that's kind of changing things a little bit. And then the clause with a verb in the past tense of the indicative with a particle on. Now, it's not necessarily the same tense as the A clause. In other words, you might have an imperfect in the A clause and an aorist in the conclusion, or you might even have a perfect form. We haven't got to those yet, but that's also one of the past tenses. So, in other words, it can be either in either clause, it might be imperfect, it might be aorist, it might be perfect, or pluperfect even. So those, the perfect and pluperfect we haven't talked about yet. Yes?
I had a little note here. I was reading a Dana Manning, and they said that the imperfect was used as a present tense, and the aorist was used as a past tense. And I didn't see that you brought that out here. I don't know.
With regard to this type C situation only? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you're familiar with that. Or...
Yes, well, it's. I think what's happening there is that once we get to this in section 354 on the next page, you'll see why he can get a sense of a present there. It's only because of the progressive aspect of the thing and the fact that it's hypothetical. See, the thing is dealing with hypothetical situation. So you're not really dealing with actual history where you can lock things into a time so easily. And when you go to an imperfect and get a progressive aspect, and then you're dealing with a hypothetical, I think that's what's happening to it. I don't know if I would analyze it quite, you know, just saying a present sense only, just combining the hypothetical nature and the progressive aspect is probably what's happening there. I mean, I can see why he said what he said, but I'm not so sure I'd word it quite that way, just because if we say, well, imperfect can be present here, you know, the person that reads that statement and doesn't realize all the qualifications may be plugging in presents and imperfects in other places and getting in trouble. So that's why I just have enough experience to know what people can do and will do if they only read part of a grammar book, that I worry, you know, I get a little nervous when I see wording like that. But I can understand why you might say that. We'll get to that when we look at this in a bit. Okay, that's the basic. Now, that chart might be something you could use to memorize the basic pattern. It's not that complicated, really. There's a remark here at the top of the next page. Other types of conditional sentences involve the optative mood. These, which are not frequently found in the New Testament, were taken up in less than 50. So optative will get involved in conditions as well. And the optative, of course, lends itself to that because it's dealing with hypothetical and possibility type of things as well. Okay. Now section 352 is going to talk about type A clauses, and then section 352, 3 type B, and 354 type C, so we can get a little bit more of a feeling as to what these things are doing. Section 352, now remember the type A started out with the particle A plus a verb in the indicative in any tense, and then the conclusion could be just about anything. Conditional clauses of type A express conditions which are believed by the speaker to be actual or possible. Now, that may be easy to remember in terms of, remember, the indicative mood is indicating the state of being. It's normally used when you're relating a statement of fact. And so when a conditional sentence is constructed in which the type A mode is used, indicative in the condition, it's expressing a condition which is believed to be either actual or possible. In other words, it may not be actually the situation, but it's conceived to be possible. And this is the kind you're probably finding to a large extent in promises and covenant types of situations in the New Testament, because the conditions are believed to be possible or actual. Okay, so let's look at a few examples here. Galatians 5:18, Eide pneumati agathe, uk este hypo nomon. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Okay, we find A plus agestha, indicative mood, in the condition. And just a passive form here. And so if you are led by the Spirit, and then your result or conclusion, not are you under law. So you are not under the law. Now the last statement, uk este hypo nomon, could stand all by itself as an independent clause. You are not under the law, just a statement like that. And in this case, they both happen to be in the indicative mood. But the key that sets type A apart from the others is not so much what kind of verb form you'll find in the conclusion, it's what verb form you find in the condition. That's the thing you have to watch for. Because that verb form in the condition, being in the indicative mood, is indicating that it's a condition that's believed to either be existing or possible. So to be led by the Spirit is conceived by God to be either possible or actual. So it's not something that's impossible or purely hypothetical. It's something that's conceded to be very real and imminent and possible, so forth. Yes, Mark?
I'm a little bit confused by what he means by actual, since we're dealing with something that is conditional or hypothetical. Could you elaborate? Yeah.
Well, in other words, a person may say it in terms of, if suppose you believed and you were fairly sure that a certain event had occurred, you might say, if this has happened, then this is going to happen. And your expression, if, is still, you know, like you say, the very nature of saying if is conditional. It's not stating the thing to be a fact. But the point here is that the conditions are believed by the speaker to be actual. In other words, to use the indicative means the speaker either believes it to have happened, he's not sure, but that's what he believes has happened, and or he believes it to be possible. So it is a hypothetical thing in a certain sense, you know, because he's just trying to explain a cause and effect relationship. But the choice of the indicative is giving you some sort of a insight into the way the speaker is thinking. He's thinking of this as something either that has happened, he may not have verified that it's happened, but he has pretty good confidence that it has, or that it's very, very real, very certainly possible. So it's having only to do with the belief of the speaker, not with any necessary observation of a fact. In some cases, he may have, in fact, observed it. He may know exactly that this has happened, and he still may state it this way for the benefit of the person who's, you know, done it. You know, like a parent might say to the child, you know, having discovered that the child has just done some dastardly deed, the parent may know full well that they've done that, but they may say, if you've done this, you're going to get a spanking, you see. And just to show the child and illustrate the cause and effect relationship between his actions and his punishment. It could be done in a situation like that, but it's mainly geared to the belief of the speaker, not to the actual fact itself. But if the speaker believes it to be actual or possible, he'll use the indicative.
As in the next example, they persecuted me.
Right.
They persecuted you. Well,
good.
He knew that they already had persecuted.
Sure.
Degree, so.
Sure. Yeah, and he knew that they knew it too. You know, if they persecuted me, and you all know they have, you see, they'll persecute you. That's a good example. And there especially, you see, you have a past tense verb form there too, which is usually indicating a fact that has happened that could be verified. But again, he's not really asserting that they persecuted him in this sentence. In fact, sometimes you'll see this where you'll have a logical progression. You'll have a logical argument. And what you'll see is maybe a statement like this. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. They persecuted me. Statement. Therefore, they will persecute you also. In other words, you're just getting to your simple, basic logical deduction. And so the hypothetical, if they persecuted me, doesn't really assert that they have. But you can see from the way this is constructed, he's believing that they have, and he knows that they know it. Sometimes maybe that may not even be stated in the sentence, but I mean, even in the context. It's a fact. It's quite an obvious fact from the whole historical narrative. But I think you've got a good example here of exactly what we're talking about. This is speaking from the standpoint of a belief of an actual fact, or at least a possible fact. And in this case, because of the context, it would be an actual one. Okay, Glenn.
In all of these sentences, what happens if you replace if with because? Because you are led by the Spirit.
Well,
the same cause effect relationship, and it seems to be so conditional.
Yes, when you put because in there, I think you're just adding a little bit more. than what the Greek will allow. So it's kind of like what we've seen before, too. Sometimes there's a certain relationship that's there, and then when you put the because in, you're inferring a cause and effect relationship. Actually, I think it's important to make a distinction between conditionals and cause and effect. Because this can sometimes get into, this is kind of bridging into the area of logic itself. When you say because, you're attributing one event to another event in a direct cause and effect relationship. If you're saying a conditional, that may be involved, and usually is. Usually when there's conditionals, there is cause and effect relationship, but that's not always the case. Sometimes in a conditional sentence, if this thing is true, then this thing will be true, may not be because this thing caused that thing. It may be because there may be several intermediate stages of cause and effect chains that finally result in this thing down here. Or it may be because this causes something over here and sets up a certain scene, certain kind of environment under which this event is more likely to take place. Or it may just be a correlation without direct cause and effect. So, in other words, from a technical scientific standpoint, all we can say as far as conditionals is if this, then this. And not necessarily that this is causing this, but these conditions always occur together. Logically, that's all we're really saying, is that when this condition occurs, then this condition will occur. But normally in the real world, that's almost always because of cause and effect relationship, and that's why we make that connection, and that's why in most sentences, when you do that, you'll probably be getting by okay. But I give a little caution there, because it may not always be direct cause and effect. It may be because there's a whole link of cause and effect chains that are involved. It's not a direct, if we inferred that this event caused that event, we might make a mistake. In other words, let me see if I can think of a good example in scientific realm. Lots of mistakes have been made because of this, where they will have not thoroughly isolated all the factors to be tested, and they'll see a correlation between one thing and another thing and conclude that this is the cause of that thing. For example, if a person performed a test on mice, for example, and found that they took one group of mice and they exposed them to radiation and they got cancer, they might conclude that the radiation caused the cancer in mice, because if there's radiation on the mice, then there'll be cancer. However, that cancer might have been caused by something else. It might have been caused by the food you were feeding them or something else. And so the correlation between the cancer and the radiation may not be due to cause and effect. It may be due to both of these things being caused by something else, or it may be due just to the inadequacy of the isolation of the factors. So that's the only caution I give, is that normally you're going to get by okay, but be careful, because it's not always implying cause. There are ways to express a real cause and a relationship in Greek without any ambiguity, if you really want to express that. But this would be, I'd just be a little careful, because we may just be expressing, normally it's going to be cause and effect. I mean, in the real world, because there are going to be direct causes and so forth, but it may not be. In other words, if they persecuted me, they shall also persecute you. They're persecuting Christ. Would not necessarily be the cause of their persecuting the others. It just might be that the cause is their evil, malicious heart. And whenever they see anybody righteous, they're going to persecute them. So he's saying if they persecuted me, they'll also persecute you, because the cause is their evil heart and the devil and the temptations and so forth. And since I'm like you and you're like me, they're going to persecute. If they persecute me, they're going to persecute you. But we can sometimes say, because they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. Now that statement, to say because they persecuted me, they will also persecute you, can even be interpreted the same way. In other words, not necessarily even direct cause and effect between the persecuting me and persecuting you, but just saying because they persecuted me, the fact that they persecuted me is an indicator of something in their heart that's also going to be seen in you. So we kind of, you're drawing an equation to a third factor there. So that's my only caution there. Just I don't want to get too detailed. It's kind of a problem having a logic teacher teaching Greek too. So, but I just want to be real careful, because language can tie you in knots sometimes if you're not real careful with it. Yes, Tony.
It does seem that because they quite a bit stronger stronger statement.
Yeah, it does.
Actual reality, whereas
yeah.
a conditional statement leaves it more
yeah.
possible.
Right.
Not quite so direct.
Yeah. I think we need to leave it in the state that it's found and just be a little careful. And then if we have other indications from the context that eliminate all the other factors and so forth, then we can conclude logically that there may be cause and effect. But from a conditional alone, I would be careful about concluding direct cause and effect. It may oftentimes be direct, maybe indirect, but we need to be careful. Okay. Another example here, Mark 26:33, if all shall be offended in you, I shall never be offended. Here, oftentimes in English we translate it, even though I'll be offended in you, I shall never be offended. But it's actually set up in a conditional sentence. If all shall be offended in you, I shall never be offended. And he is again using the indicative here. And scandal is thesontai, in the big mouthful here. And it's a future passive, you see, shall be offended, but it's still indicative. And so the fact that he's put it in the future kind of gives it a little bit more of a hypothetical sense than a normal indicative would have. So this may not be quite as strong as some of the others, but it does sound, this may not be a perception of actuality, but of certain possibility. In other words, when he's saying this, he's expecting the possibility. And, of course, Jesus had just made some statements and so forth, you see, about them forsaking them and so forth. So he says, if all shall be offended in you, I shall never be offended. Okay, then John 1:25, why are you baptizing then if you are not the Christ, nor the Elijah, nor the prophet? This is in a question mode, but so why are you baptizing? Now that is actually the conclusion, that first phrase. The conclusion doesn't always come first. So we have to be careful about that too. If you're going to put this in the kind of order we've been working with, you'd say something like, if you're not the Christ or Elijah or the prophet, why are you baptizing? But the word order here is, why are you baptizing then if you are not? And you're putting your condition following the conclusion. That happens in English too, so it's not. But I just want to point that out lest you get confused on this. Now, then using the particle a with the negative uk, form of u, and then your verb form here in the indicative, we set this all up. And notice we've got a again here, only this time it's the form of the verb to be. It's got the circumflex accent on it. Okay. So those are some typical examples of type A, yes?
That seems like a good example of where they're believing that that's an actual situation.
Right. That's another good example, right? Because he just got done telling them, I'm not the Christ, I'm not this, and so forth. And then say, why are you baptizing then if this is the case? So yes, that would be a good example now. And they're trying to follow a logical progression here. You see, he's saying he's not on any of these, and then they're concluding, if you're not of these, why are you baptizing? So that's a good point. Again, they're perceiving this to be fact. Okay, then section 353, conditional clauses of type B express conditions which are believed by the speaker to be generally true in the present or probably realizable in the future. So that is softening it a little bit. And you can see there's a very subtle nuances here. I mean, this is not a real big blatant thing. But to put it in the subjunctive, in other words, this type B, remember, you had aon with a verb in the subjunctive as your condition. And subjunctive, by its very nature, is expressing probability, possibility, rather than actuality. And so that is setting a different tenor to it, a slightly different tenor to it. The speaker is now not so much believing this to be actual or possible, but he's believing it to be generally, perhaps generally true, or probably realizable in the future. So it's hard to say that that's different than being possible. You know, probably realizable and possible are pretty much similar ideas. But it's softening it a little bit. Future conditions are more often expressed by clauses of type B than clauses of type A. See, whenever you're dealing with the future, you've always got some uncertainty. And when you're dealing with future situations like that, it's more likely to see type B than type A. We did find one type A up there in that one example, if all shall be offended in you, but that's that it comes on the heels of another statement that expresses a certain degree of reality in the future. In other words, it comes on the basis of a prophetic statement by one who knows the future. And so that may be the reason for it in that case. But when you don't know the future, you don't know the situation, and you're talking about future conditions, then subjunctive is more appropriate. And of course, almost all of these have to be analyzed on a one-on-one basis, you know, with the context and other things considered. We're just trying to see some general observations between these various types. So the type B then, with subjunctive in the conditional clause, so examples here: Eon theles dunasai me karis, katharisai. If you wish, you can cleanse me. That is, if you wish, if you ever wish, that is, if it ever, you know, it turns out that's what you want to do, you see. It's you see, when you're talking about somebody else's will, if you wish, you're dealing again with possibility. You don't really know what that person wants to do and so forth, so you're telling him, you're giving him some guidelines or giving him some possibilities depending upon their will. Whenever human will gets involved, you can throw certainty out the window. Okay. 1 Corinthians 4:19, but I shall come to you swiftly if the Lord wills. Now here again, we find our condition in the last part of the sentence. And so elusomai de tafeos prosumas, I will come toward you quickly. Eon ho kurios thelese, and there's a subjunctive form. If he shall will it, if he desires, if he wills it. And again, there's a certain, very clear uncertainty, I think, on the part of the Apostle Paul who's saying this. He's not really sure what the Lord is going to do in the situation. And so he puts it in the subjunctive, if the Lord wishes, if the Lord wills. And, he may believe that it's generally true that this is the case. In other words, he's preparing to set his course that way, but he's including a contingency here, if the Lord wills. Then John 13:8, Eon me nipso se ukeches meros medemu. If I do not wash you, ever in the future you have no part with me. So if I do not wash you, here's a negative now using may, and subjunctive form, although nipso would be the same form either way, but the eon may pretty well sets that in order there for you. And if I do not wish you, wash you, I'm going to keep doing that, eyes go up to the next line, then you have no part with me. So condition and then result, and in the subjunctive, again, because it's dealing with pretty much in a present general condition or probably realizable condition in the future. Okay. Now that kind of a thing you might even see in the indicative in some situations too. If I don't wash you, you know, in an actual factual situation, this will not happen. But I suppose sometimes too, you would put this in a, especially for the purposes of teaching and eliciting responses from someone else's will, there might be reasons for a person in authority and so forth to purposely put things in a hypothetical state to, it's hard to describe what I'm getting at, but to kind of put some pressure on the person who's hearing this, causing him to realize that this is a very conditional thing, that this isn't something that is certain, and it's something he's going to have to exercise his will to achieve. So there may be some factors involved there in terms of the perception of the whole situation. Yes?
Do you think it may be related to the negative, the deliberative negative? I know they say the double negative with the subjunctive earlier, that there's no possibility.
Right.
So it's like you're saying, if there's no possibility that I watch you, then you'll have no part with me. Do you think that kind of meaning is being carried on here?
Well, there's a problem with it, and that's because of the kind of clause relationship that we're seeing here, the on may and the conditional. See, the prohibitory subjunctive is usually, it's used in a situation where there's an actual command that's being given, where the context is an actual command rather than a condition.
I was thinking of the negative. I guess they didn't really name it here. They just called it a negative statement, and so that makes it even more.
You mean the emphatic negative statement?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, like the aorist subjunctive is sometimes used with ume to express an emphatic negative statement. Again, there you'd need the ume, though, in order to really see that. Maybe you're saying that this is something akin to that. In other words, because they do that with that, I see what you're saying. Okay. I think you've got a point there. When you put the negative in a possibility realm, then you've got kind of no possibility. Yeah, I see what you're saying. In other words, it's not exactly the same thing because we're in a conditional, but it may be related to the same idea. Yeah, because he says, if I do not wash you, that is ever or in the future. In other words, if I never wash you, if I don't wash you ever, you see, you're in trouble. And I think that's a good point. Whenever you put a negative in a hypothetical like that, you're going to get a very strong sense to it. It's going to put more pressure on the person that is hearing this, you see. Okay. Glenn.
Looking at that Aeon, if we compare that, say, First Corinthians 4:19 is a good example, say. If you compare that to page 270, Matthew 24, I was looking at, Paul Aeon is Aeon, most of them, that looks like the same type of type B condition of flaw, or type A even. And what they call it, indefinite relative clause, why couldn't it be translated, if what is just, if it is just, I will give it to you, therefore making it a conditional clause.
You can't accept it. The only point they're making distinction about is the fact that you do have the relative pronoun in there and that it is indefinite. In other words, when you put the relative pronoun in there, you're kind of leaving it open to many different possibilities. You still got a conditional type of situation, though. You're right about that. Because, it's just that you're expressing a little bit differently. You see, when in these conditional clauses that we're looking at now, we have a very specific situation. If this specific situation happens with so-and-so and so-and-so, if he does this, then this will happen. But here, in the indefinite type situations, you've got a relative pronoun that can stand in for lots of different possible things. It's the same kind of an idea, except that it's broadened now to a general maxim involving anybody that would fit the category. And so it could be translated, for example, that Matthew 24 that you have, if anything is just, I will give it to you. That could be translated that way. Because it's just a matter of, it's the same kind of construction here. You've got on A, with a subjunctive and so forth, and then the whole would be your subject of that clause. There wouldn't be any problem with that, really. But you still get the sense of anything is just, I will give it to you, you see. And it's the anything there, that's the thing that they're designating here. And because English can translate things like that with whatsoever or whoever and so forth, then the English construction is coming out with a indefinite relative pronoun, and that's what they're using. That's why they lump these all in the same chapters, because they're really dealing with the same kind of a concept.
But in all of these, in the conditional part, the A and the Aeon are always right at the start of the sentence, or right at the start of the
clause. Of the clause, the clause would be better.
It follows the pronoun. Can it then follow something, or be in the middle or out of order or something, or is that by following the relative pronoun, does that making it indefinite enough to keep it out of this other...
That may be an indicator. I would have to look at more examples. It looks like all the examples here do that. Either if it's A or if it's on, it's coming at the beginning of the clause. And not the beginning of the sentence, but the beginning of the clause. And whatever subject and so forth is following that, that's a good point. That may be just a word order thing that's indicating this kind of construction. Functionally, there's similarities between them. But I'm a little reluctant to say this is always the case unless we looked at, a full range of examples. We've only got a relatively small sampling. It certainly looks like we've got enough of a sampling to say this is the pattern. But whether it's occurring in every instance that way, I'm not so sure. I would suspect, though, see, when you're using this indefinite relative pronoun, that seems to be the thing that's zeroed in on. And that may be the reason why it's occurring in the first position all of these places. So that may serve to make some sort of a distinction, but meaning-wise, semantically, they're getting into a very similar idea.
Matthew 24 couldn't be a conditional sentence because it fits the word. If anything is just, I will give you. We wouldn't. The whole is the.
Oh yes. Okay. Yeah, you'd have to have a resumptive. You'd have to have another pronoun, another pronoun in the last to make that independent. In other words, that's a good point there. See, when you put a relative pronoun into something, that whole clause is kind of dependent on the, is a functional part of the other clause. So the only way you could get by structurally, you know, the same way, in other words, grammatically, as Mark said, it's a good observation, is to put something else in there. In other words, you could do it with putting another ho, say, in the last clause, dikai undo so ho, you mean, you know, and then put, you know, another pronoun in there to make that independent. Yeah, but if it's not independent, you see, now you've tied these things together. With a conditional, you really have two clauses. One of them's an independent clause. It can stand by itself, and the other one is dependent. Here, you've got a kind of a mixed situation where one's a constituent part of the other, and that's a good point. Technically, that's going to make a significant difference grammatically. But still, of course, the bottom line still is it's a similar kind of an idea. That's what they put together. But the forms of them and so forth will be easy to distinguish on that basis. Good. Okay. Appreciate that. Anyone else have a question on this? All right. Section 354, conditional clauses of type C express hypothetical conditions, that is, conditions which the speaker himself believes to be contrary to fact. All right, and so this has a different sense. Now, again, this is what the speaker believes. This does not necessarily mean that the situation is, in fact, contrary to fact. It just means that the speaker believes it contrary to fact. So this is your contrary to fact type of situation. Look, for example, and of course, type C is where we used A with the verb in the past tense and the indicative for the condition, and then a clause of the verb in the past tense of the indicative for the conclusion. And it's kind of a, how do I say this? It's kind of covering the negative side of a cause and effect relationship or of a conditional relationship. Look at the example here. I think it may help to illustrate it. If the Lord had not shortened the days, all flesh would not have been saved. So if the Lord had not shortened the days, but he did, you see, in other words, the speaker believes that the Lord did shorten the days. But he's wording it, if the Lord had not shortened the days, then this never would happen. But his perception is, he's believing the Lord did shorten the days, and it's a good thing he did, because if he hadn't, then this would have happened. So, and what we're finding here is A, with the a verb in the past tense, and then in the conclusion, we're finding a verb in the past tense, also the indicative. So, A may echo lobosen, if the Lord had not shortened, if he had not shortened the days, then an esothe, the verb form there, would not have been saved. Uk an esothe pasa sarx, all flesh would not have been saved. So this is a very common type of expression, and type C clauses are going to occur quite frequently. But it's, again, dealing with hypotheticals and dealing with the negative side of the hypothetical. And it's dealing with a condition that the speaker doesn't believe to have actually existed. But he's just kind of saying, one condition did prevail, but if it hadn't prevailed, if there was another condition that prevailed, then such and such would have happened. Sometimes that may be used also to prove that a certain condition didn't exist. You know, sometimes when you get into logical arguments again, if such and such had not happened, then such and such, but such and such did happen, therefore such and such. So you get into modus tollens and things like that, where you with logic and things like this. Okay, John 8:42, another example. Eho theos pater himon in agapata on emet. If God were your father, but he isn't, you would have loved me. In other words, you see, if God were your father, and that's a statement that's contrary to the belief of the speaker. So Jesus didn't believe that God was their father. It says you would have loved me. Okay, and here you're using ain, you're using an imperfect form in the first and then an aorist in the second. So it's, again, past tenses in both cases. They don't have to be the same past tense. The aspect can be different, but they're both past tense.
I think we looked into this, it sounds almost like the Hebrew, where they delete the rest of it and they just say...
Oh, yes.
Because it's got this negative, you know, here they shall improve. In other words, they shall not.
There's a relationship between those things. It's, I think, though, in the Greek, when you will find some places where In this one, if God were your father, he's believing the negative part. God is not your father. So it doesn't quite line up with that, because in some instances you'll have an A, and in Greek you'll have to translate a not in there, even though it's not there, and even in your translation, because it's a carry through from the Hebrew idiom. In other words, that Hebrew idiom does carry right into Greek and translated into Greek, but maybe more transliterated in a sense as far as the grammar. And in that situation, you have to almost add something that's not even there in the Greek. Here, there's a connection between these ideas, but it's not quite as direct. Okay, we'll have to stop here. And for tomorrow, let me see if we can give you part of 45, so we can get started with this at least. Why don't we do 45A and B, and we'll leave C and D for the next day. So A and B of lesson 45. I don't think those will be too taxing. Not a bunch of paradigms, at least.
Yes.
If you didn't get your test paper...